This is KVNF, and it's time for Local Motion. This week, I speak with two journalists who've written recently about the climate crisis. Acclaimed author and Guardian reporter Chris McGreal talks about lawsuits filed by local Colorado governments accusing energy companies ExxonMobil and Suncor of deceptive practices, consumer fraud, and suppressing evidence from their own scientists, all exacerbating the climate problem for profit. Then Sarah Sachs, new climate justice fellow at High Country News, speaks with me from the Pacific Northwest about their scary hot summer and why we should not give up trying to save the planet based on the latest IPCC report. Catastrophe can still be avoided. Stay tuned. Chris McGreal writes for The Guardian US, is former Guardian correspondent in Washington, Johannesburg, and Jerusalem. He's also author of American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. Publishers Weekly called the book an urgent, readable chronicle, which names names and pulls no punches. Very excited to welcome you to our airwaves, Chris. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
Your article, Who Should Pay for Climate Mitigation? Colorado Looks to the Oil Industry, out this month in The Guardian, was republished by High Country News and other outlets as part of Covering Climate Now, a global journalism collaboration strengthening coverage of the climate story. That partnership means more readers have access to your reporting and other stories, even if they've never heard of The Guardian. For those unfamiliar, can you talk about its role as an outlet in the UK and around the English-speaking world? The Guardian features reporters like you who name names and pull no punches. In some ways, does that set it apart from other so-called mainstream media?
To some degree, yes. The Guardian is celebrating its 200th year. It was founded in Manchester as a newspaper, a weekly newspaper back then, became a daily, and then in the 1960s moved to London, which was a big change. And of course, the other big change of recent times is that the Guardian has become international to the extent it's now available online, and amongst the offices, the operations we have is a separate America operation, Guardian US, which essentially brings in the best of the Guardian from around the world, reporting in Britain and elsewhere, but also adds an element of American reporting to that focus on America. And I think that's very much, you know, part of what the Guardian is about, is telling the stories and investigating the stories that perhaps other newspapers, other news outlets don't always follow through on, or looking at them in ways that are away from what a lot of more mainstream newspapers might do. Of course, it's worth bearing in mind that it was The Guardian that broke the Edward Snowden revelations. It was The Guardian that published WikiLeaks. And so it's a newspaper and a news publication that's kind of very much been at the forefront of bringing people things they really need to know.
My guest is journalist Chris McGreal. Lawsuits here in Colorado accuse energy companies of deceptive practices that escalate the climate crisis. You write about a nagging fear that local communities are living on borrowed time, replicated across Western states ravaged by more and more intense wildfires. But you also write that angst is accompanied by questions about the long-term financial cost of survival and who should foot the bill. In one example, Boulder County, what are some of the things they would like to do, and what does the cost to do them look like?
Well, Boulder County is suing alongside the city of Boulder. And really what they're looking for, they know that, and we can see it today, can't we, around the world, but also right where you are, the impact of climate crisis, the impact both with the wildfires, with drought, with floods. Everybody can see that the climate is changing, and actually perhaps changing faster than they had expected. And that's already bringing costs. But when you think to the future, not only is there the cost of the damage caused by this, there's the cost of preparation. There's the cost of protecting communities from what might happen. And that's one of the things that Boulder County is focused on. So they've calculated that over the next three decades, they will spend $100 million just on adapting transport and drainage to climate change. Just those two things alone are going to cost, you know, an enormous amount of money for the county. And that's on top of anything else from, you know, the damage caused by fires or floods or any other form of preparation that needs to be made, adapting emergency services, for instance. So, and you see this in communities across the United States, particularly those, of course, on the coast, but also inland.
So who does Boulder County say should pay the bill?
Well, in this particular lawsuit, they focused on two oil companies, ExxonMobil, which is the largest oil company in the United States, and Suncor, which is a Canadian oil company with a refinery outside of Denver, Colorado. And it says that in terms of impact in the Boulder area, those two oil companies have had more impact than any others because of their size, because of the gas stations they own, their refineries, various factors. They've calculated that these are the two that can be most directly held responsible.
Boulder County isn't the only Colorado government agency suing energy companies. You mentioned City of Boulder. You also write about San Miguel County here on the Western Slope. What are their specific accusations?
Well, they all have very similar accusations. And at the core of the lawsuit is the idea that the oil industry, Exxon and Suncor, but other oil companies as well, have spent decades lying about climate change, covering up about climate change. At its core, it says that they knew from their science, from their own research, that climate change was coming, that in fact, a climate crisis was coming. Exxon in particular had quite an extensive research back in the 1970s and 80s. Its own scientists told it that the climate was changing quite dramatically. They had predictions of the situation that we are actually now in at this point and of how bad it would get. And the company back in those days took it seriously enough that in fact, one of Exxon's oil tankers was fitted out with scientific equipment to go around the globe and measure water temperature changes and climate changes as a way of gathering data. And one of the things that comes out in the lawsuit is that it's clear that the oil industry took these things seriously because you see oil companies adapt to it themselves. They start to make changes to their oil platforms at sea because of rising waters. They make changes to oil refineries in places that might be vulnerable. So they realize that there's damage being done. At the same time, according to these lawsuits and, you know, quite a lot of extensive evidence that has come out over the years, the oil industry pursued a policy of firstly simply denying that there was a climate crisis when it became apparent that that was an untenable situation. It essentially did what the tobacco industry did and said, there's no scientific proof. The jury's still out, we're still investigating. But at the same time, it shut down its own investigations. Exxon, for instance, would no longer have scientists telling it that climate change was happening. So what the lawsuit accuses Exxon and Suncor of is a huge deception. And that, they say, breaches Colorado state's consumer fraud laws, deceptive trade practices. Those are the grounds on which they're suing.
Suppressed evidence from their own scientists, funding front groups to question science as the climate emergency escalated. This is such a key part of your piece. And in case you're just joining us, we're talking to Chris McGreal. His article is Who Should Pay for Climate Mitigation? Colorado Looks to the Oil Industry. But you're also the author of the book American Overdose. You wrote about pharmaceutical companies. Do you see parallels between the energy industry and big pharma?
Yes, you see them follow very similar pattern of denial. So with the pharmaceutical industry, once it becomes apparent that they're flooding the United States with very powerful prescription opioids and people are becoming addicted and beginning to die in very large numbers, and it's worth bearing in mind this is the only country in the world where this was happening, they then go into the mode that I've really just described of trying to deny the evidence. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways they do that is very similar with both the energy industry and the tobacco industry is they create front organizations to question the science. They create what are supposed to be popular organizations, groups that are well funded by the industry, but hidden. The source of funding is hidden to demand either more drugs or more oil or more cigarettes. And of course, they use their trade groups to put pressure both on federal regulators and on Congress. Lobbyists fund, you know, fund individual members of Congress. They fund the Republican Party in particular. And you see this with actually all three of these industries, that they follow a very similar pattern. And with the opioid industry, what you've seen with recent trials that are now taking place is that the discovery process and the trials has revealed a very cynical approach of deny that there is a problem with the drugs and to blame the user. Mm-hmm. To blame the person who becomes addicted and overdoses and dies, and say it's not the drug that's the problem that's getting them addicted, it's the person who uses it that's the problem. And that's very similar to the oil industry's approach right now, is to say gasoline's not the problem, pumping oil is not the problem, climate change, climate crisis created by people who drive their cars. So it's not Exxon's fault, it's your fault for driving your car.
Not unlike Al Gore, for example, you write, high-income communities are susceptible to charges of hypocrisy for their high carbon footprints due to heating and cooling, larger than average homes, for example. The Denver Post editorial board pushed this line a few years ago. What was the gist of their argument? You described it in your piece.
So the Denver Post editorial board, they denounced what they called the false equivalence between cigarette companies and big oil, saying that in the case of big oil, it was the consumer who bore the greater responsibility for the climate crisis. I mean, to quote them, they say, the companies didn't create the demand for fossil fuels. We did through our lifestyles and consumption, including every single member of the communities who now wish to target corporations for a legal shakedown. This is a nonsense. There's study after study that shows that whilst we all, of course, through our lifestyles contribute to the climate crisis, the difference that's going to be made in cutting the emissions comes from huge industrial changes, not simply people driving more fuel efficient cars. And those industrial changes are a shift, for instance, from gasoline to electric vehicles, which the oil industry is pushing very hard against. In essence, what the oil industry is trying to do is to keep selling its product in exactly the same way and say that it does not have responsibility for what's going on.
You also talked to the director of the Environmental Studies Program at CU Boulder, who says that doesn't mean we should let energy companies off the hook for their role in the climate crisis. So is it safe to say he supports these lawsuits?
Yes, very much so. I mean, his argument is, yes, we all have responsibilities. This is Max Boykoff. He says we all have responsibilities, individual responsibilities, but the greater responsibility lies with the oil industry, the energy industry, partly because of the cover-up that we've been talking about, partly because they delayed through the lies and the misrepresentations and the twisting of science. They delayed the opportunity for the rest of us to actually have acted much earlier. And because of that, he says that that puts a greater weight of responsibility on them to now meet the financial costs that will be coming at Boulder and, you know, many other communities.
Journalist Chris McGreal joins me on Local Motion. We're talking about his article in The Guardian about local governments in Colorado suing energy companies to pay for climate mitigation. Exxon and Suncor hope to move the trials out of state courts. Why?
This is something you see with a lot of the lawsuits across the country, is that the oil industry sees the advantage of being a federal court. And the reason for this is that, firstly, state courts allow for this thing of suing for consumer fraud, for deceptive trade practices. There is no such method of suing under federal law. It doesn't exist. They firstly want to remove that issue. Secondly, state law allows, or in many states, including Colorado, a much more intrusive, for want of a better word, discovery process. So when you sue in state court, the plaintiffs are able to get much greater access frequently to internal documents from a company than they would be in federal court. The argument is made by the oil companies, it belongs in federal court because these are national issues affected by federal legislation, such as the Clean Air Act. Therefore, it belongs in federal court. Once they get it into federal court, they're arguing, well, these are really not issues that could be dealt with by legislation. These are political issues, and therefore they should be dealt with by Congress and by the president. And therefore, all of these cases should be thrown out. And so it's they're attempting a two-step process, move it to federal court and then get the whole legal process killed. That's what they would like to see happen.
We just have 1 minute left. So one thing you didn't have room for in this story is what happens next? What's the timeline on these lawsuits? When will we know if the energy companies are successful getting them moved to a more favorable jurisdiction for their defense?
Well, we don't know. It's going to take a while. There are these legal cases going through various state courts. At some point, I imagine that it's going to go up, be appealed much further up the federal process, and it will end up before the Supreme Court, or at least that's what many of the lawyers expect. At that point, it's very hard to call for sure which way it will go, given the makeup of the present Supreme Court.
Sure.
I think people are, you know, lawyers fighting these cases in Colorado and other states and other cities are sort of bedding in for long term. They think this could take a while. Although, having said that, you just need one state court to proceed, open up the process to discovery. Information can come out, documents can come out. And as we've seen with both tobacco and the pharmaceutical industry, that can change the trajectory very fast.
That's journalist Chris McGreal. His article, Who Should Pay for Climate Mitigation? Colorado Looks to the Oil Industry, is out this month in The Guardian, High Country News, and elsewhere. His highly acclaimed book is American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. Thanks so much for speaking with KVNF, Chris.
My pleasure.
I'm News Director Gavin Dahl. You're tuned to Local Motion on Mountain Grown, Public Radio, KVNF. Next, we move from Colorado to the Pacific Northwest. My guest is Sarah Sachs, climate justice reporter at High Country News. Her latest for HCN on why the IPCC report matters, what it says about climate change, and how communities can prepare was just published on August 13th. Thanks for joining me on KVNF, Sarah.
Thanks for having me here.
So tell us about yourself. What were you doing before you started HCN? This is a relatively new role, yeah?
Yeah, I actually just started about a month ago as their climate justice reporter. And before that, I was freelancing based out of New York, but my family is from Washington and BC. So kind of at heart, I'm from the Pacific Northwest.
Well, what a way to start your gig at High Country News with what you call the most dire warning yet from hundreds of scientists around the globe who make up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Why do most researchers consider the IPCC's assessment of climate science in our world authoritative? Who are these folks?
Well, the IPCC essentially is the member countries of the UN decide on scientists from their country who volunteer their time to go through tens of thousands of peer-reviewed scientific papers to come up with this assessment of the state of climate science. And so in some ways it's considered the most authoritative because it's both in some ways the biggest. There's just so much effort and time and papers that go into this. And also its kind of global nature means that it's not done from the perspective of one country, but it's really done from a global perspective.
And so then what has changed about the practice of climate science since the publication of the last one of these reports about 8 years ago?
There's obviously been a lot more information that has become available about climate science. You know, climate science as a science is constantly evolving. There's new journals that are being brought out. There's a lot more models that are being built. The models are getting better. And so you just basically have a huge amount of information that's coming in. And then on top of that, you have much more fine scale and much better regional and local climate science that's feeding basically these global assessments.
The first three words in the newly released sixth assessment report from the IPCC are, it is unequivocal. They state the climate crisis has been caused by human activities and every corner of the planet. You write, all of Earth's systems are already affected. In other words, the effects of climate change are here now. Then the report warns the collapse of major Atlantic currents, melting of the ice caps, the elimination of nearly all of the Amazonian rainforest cannot be ruled out, but there is also optimism. The final section of the new IPCC report is focused on limiting future climate change. The science is clear that if emissions are slashed, temperatures will stop rising in a decade or two. In fact, if we get to zero carbon emissions, warming could slowly go in reverse. Do you agree with my take that this means we should absolutely not feel paralyzed from taking action and learning about this?
100%. So when you say unequivocal, it also means that we know for sure 100% that humans are causing the climate to warm and the climate to change. And I think that's one thing that the IPCC report does, is it basically takes all the science and it says, how certain are we that the glaciers are going to melt? How certain are we that humans are causing climate change? How certain are we that temperatures are going to rise 2 degrees by 2050 versus 4? And so every subsequent IPCC report is able to say with more certainty, yes, it's humans. Yes, these are what the impacts are going to be. And so having that precision also allows us to say, hey, we know that actually the difference between 0.1 degree warming is 10 million additional climate refugees. It is, you know, this amount less of glacial loss. And so I think having that precision allows us to say, yes, we 100% should act immediately and try to basically make whatever changes we can to stop the climate from warming, because we know that every tiny bit of a degree is going to make a difference in how fast the climate warms and how extreme climate change actually becomes.
That's Sarah Sachs, climate justice reporter at High Country News. The headline of her new piece at hcn.org is, "Every part of a degree of warming that we can avert will make the future better." You speak in depth with Amy Snover, director of the Climate Impacts Group at the University of Washington in Seattle. We'll get to that in a moment, but first, outline for our listeners from the first paragraph of your article what you call a frightening preview of a hotter future that the Northwest has experienced this summer.
Sure. The Northwest, I think in particular, you know, and obviously I'm slightly biased because I live here now, but so many of the things that are predicted in the report and so many of the things that the report states will happen in the future are happening right now. You know, we've just had this incredible heat dome that had record temperatures in, you know, Lytton for a while, and BC was one of the hottest places on Earth. Portland had record-breaking temperatures, you know, this really intense heat. We've had wildfires that have been absolutely disastrous, even though it's not even peak or wasn't even peak wildfire season. People are really concerned about the salmon runs this year because of the rivers heating up so much and because there being less water. And so it's a really dire situation. And I think a lot of climate scientists are looking at this and saying, this is what the models predict will happen in the future. And this is what the models predicted would happen 20 years ago. Like, we are living what the science says is going to happen.
So in terms of what you learned in your own conversation with UW's Amy Snover, share what she outlined as, in her opinion, the biggest climate risks in the Northwest, certainly things you've just mentioned.
So the three things that Amy outlined in our conversation were changes to the water systems. So less snowpack and stream flow when we don't need it and not when we do need it. Another one she outlined was impacts on forest ecosystems. So more wildfire and more disease. And then the third one was issues with sea level rise and coastal flooding.
My hometown, Seattle, was built on the stolen traditional land of the Coast Salish people, including Duwamish, Suquamish, Stillaguamish, and Muckleshoot tribes. The population of King County grew over 17%, according to the 2020 census, up from 1.9 million to nearly 2.3 million people in the past decade. I learned from your piece that King County Executive Dow Constantine has named climate equity a priority for his administration. What does Amy Snover say about the distribution of climate risk?
So there's two things that we talked about in our conversation. One is that governments all over Washington, from local governments to the governor's office, are all increasingly starting to think about not just how climate change will impact ecosystems, but also really think about the people that will be most impacted by climate change, which broadly speaking is known as climate justice and climate equity. So thinking about, you know, if climate does change in certain ways, then people who are low income, people of color, people living in floodplains are going to be affected first. And so therefore a lot of resources should be, you know, disproportionately going to those who will disproportionately be affected. And so one of the things she's saying is that governments are starting to really think about this and to think about climate change and climate equity and put it into their policies. And then another thing that, you know, she talked about was that these vulnerabilities just do really exist, and we still need to do a lot more research to figure out who are the people who are most vulnerable, when will they be most vulnerable, how do we best help them?
Let's talk about actions. You and I agree, folks listening to this interview should not feel paralyzed about the climate crisis. What does Amy Snover say we should be doing?
Depends a little bit on who the we is. If you're a politician, part of it will be considering how you can include climate change and climate equity into your policies. If you're a builder, if you're a developer, it will be thinking about how climate change is going to affect where you're building, what you're building, the materials you're using to build things with. And if you're a person, she says, you know, the biggest thing you can do is actually talk to your politicians, talk to people in government and tell them that you're really concerned and that they should be considering climate change. You know, at one point she said basically anything that lives longer than 10 years should be considering climate change, and policies and regulations and zoning ordinances and everything need to be considering climate change.
You quoted Amy Snover from the University of Washington, and the High Country News website has it as a pull quote: "This will just keep getting worse until we stop it." And that in itself is a bit of a call to action, isn't it?
Of course. Yeah, I think that, and that goes kind of hand in hand with this idea that every part of a degree of warming needs to be averted, or every part of a degree will make the future better, is that we've already locked in a certain amount of warming, and we already know that there are consequences, even if we were to achieve zero emissions today, carbon neutrality today, we've locked in a certain amount of warming. So we know that there are going to be impacts, and we need to be considering those. And if we don't stop now, then in 20, 30 years, those impacts will just be worse. And so that call to action is to also think about the ways in which we can, you know, I think it's unanimous, is that we need to achieve zero emissions, we need to achieve carbon neutrality immediately. And, you know, we need to have achieved it yesterday. And if we can't do that, then we need to achieve it tomorrow. And so, you know, getting to that goal should be a priority, I think, for the world.
That's Sarah Sachs, climate justice reporter at High Country News. You can read her interview with Amy Snover at hcn.org. What's next for you, Sarah?
Well, as the climate justice reporter, I'm looking specifically at the Northwest from a climate justice angle. So I'll be looking at what the impacts of climate change are in the region, but I'll also be looking at how climate change is affecting most of the state's vulnerable populations, is disproportionately affecting certain demographics, and looking at what policies exist and what policies maybe should exist in order to make sure that the risks of climate change are borne equally. Next on my list is to look for stories that focus on climate equity. And so I'll be investigating those for the next couple of months.
Sarah Sachs, High Country News, thanks for speaking with KVNF on Local Motion.
Thanks for having me.